Thank you all so much for coming here today. Can you hear me? Excellent. Great. Welcome to Americans Abroad. My name is Dawn Tripp, and I'll be moderating the panel discussion today. I'm a novelist with Random House. My second novel won the Massachusetts Book Award for Fiction. My third and most recent book, Game of Secrets, was a Boston Globe bestseller. My essays on writing have been published in Psychology Today, the Virginia Quarterly Review, and on NPR. And I'm thrilled to be here today at the Boston Book Festival. As you'll see on your chairs, there's a brief survey, and if you would take a few minutes and fill that out at the end of our discussion, that would be fantastic. And also after, at 1:30, our panel will run for about an hour, and at 1:30, all four authors will be available to sign books right outside in the library. So I'd like to start by introducing our four panelists today. Henriette Power is the founder of The Drum, a literary magazine which publishes fiction, essays, and interviews exclusively in audio form. A Greek-American writer and Rhodes Scholar, Henriette's work has appeared in The Millions, The New York Times Online, Narrative Magazine, The New England Review, and elsewhere. Her first novel, The Clover House, was a Target Emerging Author selection and lauded as a stunning debut by USA Today. The Boston Globe praises The Clover House as an insightful examination of memory and stories, a compelling fictional portrait that illuminates and contrasts the Greece of today with the country during the troubled era of the early 1940s, under Italian occupation and burgeoning fascism. I always have a little trouble with that word. Christopher Castellani is the artistic director of the Grub Street Writer Center in Boston. He is the author of two previous critically acclaimed novels, A Kiss from Maddalena, which won the Massachusetts Book Award for Fiction, and The Saint of Lost Things, which was longlisted for the Impact Dublin Literary Award. His third novel, All This Talk of Love, was an Indie Next pick and an editor's choice in the New York Times, which praised the novel's dark, elegiac heart. We love that phrase, don't we?
We do.
Yeah. The Boston Globe describes Castellani's story of an Italian-American family as rich and entertaining. His evocations of the love between parents and their grown children and the ambivalence of immigrants toward their old and new homes is nuanced and original. Russ Reimer is the author of two previous works of nonfiction, Jeannie, a Scientific Tragedy, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and American Beach, a saga of race, wealth, and memory, which was named a New York Times notable book. Russ is a journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the New Yorker, National Geographic, and other publications. His debut novel, Paris Twilight, is praised by the New York Journal of Books as brilliant, strongly recommended, a suspenseful story narrated in gorgeous elegiac prose.
I love that word.
I love that word.
I'm feeling very left out.
Right?
I'm feeling
no elegiac for you.
Not dark. Not dark. Just fascism.
Just fascism. It was named an editor's choice by Apple, which described it as bold, complex, and beautiful, with vivid explorations of everything from the Spanish Civil War to the measure of true love. Caleb Crane has written for The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, The Nation, The New York Times, among others. A graduate of Harvard, he is the author of a critical work, American Sympathy. His debut novel, Necessary Errors, is a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice and a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick, and was described in Harper's as a sparkling first novel about youth, ambition, and self-invention in early 1990s Prague. New York Review of Books praises it as polished, dry but tender, ferociously observed. This novel probes deeply in an unexpectedly playful manner into some fundamental matters: love, friendship, solidarity, vocation, the pursuit of truth. So one of the joys for me in moderating this particular panel is that I got to take about 10 days away from my own novel in progress, which is due at the end of January, and I got to immerse myself in the exquisite worlds of these four stories, and I could call it work. Each of these books is so finely crafted with its own distinct voice style and logic, and each is a truly beautiful work of fiction in its own right. I have to say that the books that I love most are those that have a real sense of life on the page. As a writer, I write for that quality of life, and as a reader, I read for it. And I feel that these four novels embody the best of what fiction can be. They're unique, spellbinding stories that entertain, and at the same time, they change how we see, what we think and feel and believe. One of the things that struck me is how each of you treated this question of place in very different ways in your novel. And I'm hoping that each of you could speak briefly to this, about how place, that other place abroad, functions, you know, in the course of your particular story. Go.
All right, I'm going to go. Because in The Clover House, it's a kind of utopia, but in the literal Greek sense of the word, a place that is no place, because the Greece that the protagonist Callie is trying to reconnect with is a Greece that doesn't exist anymore, because it's the Greece of her mother's childhood, and she can never, of course, she can never recreate that, and she can never really connect with a remembered place. She has to go and experience and create a new place. So there's always this utopia that's always out of reach, that she's always chasing. And I think that's what I tried to convey with, while at the same time evoking the details of the city that she goes to as vividly as I could. I wanted to convey also that, you know, you cannot go home again, as the famous phrase says, and there's always going to be something that's missing.
Yeah, that's very similar in my book. And when I was speaking with someone about my novel, which is both about two immigrants, two parents, and their two adult first generation children. This person I was speaking with is a first generation son, and he had said to me, that he felt that as a first generation kid, that he felt that he was immediately born into a loss. A loss that he, because his parents were always talking about this other place, and they had treated it in some ways like this utopia, like this wonderful heritage that this person was born into. But of course, that person, us first generation immigrants, don't actually have access to that. And even if we go back, even if we look at the pictures, even if we hear the music and taste the food, we actually are born into this experience that we haven't had, and yet we feel like we should feel something for. That's a lot about how Italy in my book functions for the various characters on both sides.
You know, I'm still not sure if I set my book in Paris as a way of escape or as a method of encounter. I confess that the story is about a 50-year-old woman lives in New York. She's a professor of anesthesiology, and she goes to Paris to participate in a heart transplant that she comes to suspect is suspicious. And suspecting that it's suspicious is something she's right to do, but she has the wrong reasons. Another thing happens to her in that she inherits an apartment from a stranger once she's there, and the apartment contains mysteries that in some ways come to explain her life to herself. So there's these two plots, and as a first-time novelist, I think that, truthfully, that was about as much as I could handle. So it was very nice to be able to take her away from her friends, take her away from her family, get her out of New York, and put her in an environment that I knew better than she did, because I know Paris fairly well, where I could control things. Of course, I found out quickly that this was totally out of control, despite my efforts. There's a maxim that one is never so much oneself as when one travels. And I found that, like my character, putting things in this distant remove led me further and further into an encounter of not just what I thought about Paris and my own experiences there, but what I thought about myself.
So. My novel is about a young man named Jacob Putnam who goes to Prague a year or so after college. And I think that Prague was, useful. I mean, I had an opportunistic reason in that I had been to Prague 25 years ago, so I could draw on those memories. But I think it was useful as a setting because it was a place that was very much between. It was between communism and capitalism. Communism had officially been overthrown, but capitalism hadn't really arrived yet. So things were kind of still working on the old system, but nothing really quite worked, and the new system hadn't arrived. And Jacob, as a character, is sort of between childhood and adulthood. So he's also between worlds, and he's between not being quite straight and being openly gay. And Prague is between East and West. The word actually means Praha, it means threshold in Czech. So it worked that way. And the other thing about the setting that I realized sort of didn't plan but retrospectively worked was that it was utopian in that it was the world before cell phones and the internet. that I didn't intend, it just sort of happened as I was writing it. It's like, oh, that's right. You know, it was hard to get a hold of people in 1990 in Prague. If you didn't know where they lived and couldn't actually go knock on their door, because they didn't always even have landlines, let alone cell phones. So it was also remembering a different time or a different way of experiencing time in a particular place. So.
And I'm curious, did you go back to refresh your memory?
Last time I was there was 1993. So while I was writing, I deliberately didn't go back because I didn't want to refresh my memory. I wanted to not have it confuse me with new experiences.
See, that was the other reason I decided on Paris, because I could go back.
And okay.
I never did, and never got there.
Caleb, towards the opening of Necessary Errors, there is a line that reads, Jacob had arrived in Prague with a project. He couldn't see that he was carrying it. He would not have understood that it took the shape of a story he wanted to live out. In fact, in an early assessment of Prague, Jacob decides, it was no different here. It was like home. You know, and that's a very fluid thought, and it's a flaw of, you know, a thought that changes. It was like home. This place abroad is like home. And this question of home has such different meanings in each of these four novels. Chris, in all this talk of love, the journey abroad has a different context because the trip back to Santa Cecilia, did I pronounce that right?
Close enough.
Excellent. Yeah. Is also a homecoming for the Grasso family. And similarly, in the Clover House, Callie, a first-generation Greek-American, is called back to her mother's ancestral home of Patras. And Russ, in Paris Twilight, your protagonist, Matilda, as you said, arrives in Paris, you know, for one, like a daylight reason of participating in this heart transplant, and that, you know, but she's, you know, she's immersed in a, you know, and drawn into a, you know, a parallel journey that's much more, you know, about her own, an excavation of her own past. So this question, though, I felt in the course of each of these books, there's a driving quest of your characters to really come to a different understanding of what home is. And can you talk a little bit about that, about how that quest for understanding home and how that arc of what home, you know, that understanding of what home is, how that evolves over the course of the story? You want to start, Caleb?
Sure. the first thing that comes to mind is that the quote that you read about it was like home is actually, for Jacob, that's a negative thing.
Right.
That's a moment when he's realizing that the problems that he had being gay in the Boston area, actually, were going to be replicated in Prague, that it wasn't going to be the utopia. I think my novel is about sort of these ideas that you have, especially if you're young, about the world and how they prove wrong. And yet, where do you get these ideas? You probably get them from home.
Right.
And if you go abroad, that's kind of this blank canvas because you don't officially know anything about it. So you're sort of, what you're carrying with you maybe becomes more visible to you as you do your reality testing. But I think by the end of the novel, Jacob has made enough mistakes that he does kind of feel at home.
Right.
Which, of course, is when he leaves.
Right. But that, it's true, and you feel that tension. You feel that it's when he's on the verge of leaving that he can finally, you know, embrace this other space as a level of home inside himself, and not just simply, you know, in the city as a whole. And I love that.
Well, I think that's something. I don't know. I've Chris and I kind of, as we said, we touch on some of the same issues. And I think both as a first-generation American myself and writing about a first-generation American, sorry, for, what am I? A first-generation Greek in America. See, this is precisely the problem because I grew up being told, you're Greek. That's what my parents always said. But my protagonist has one American character and one Greek, sorry, one American parent and one Greek parent. But for both of us, the dilemma is, where are you at home? Are you at home in the foreign country, which is it foreign or is it your own? You're as we said, you're not quite at home there because it's the heritage that you've been born into, but it's not, you don't remember it the way they remember it. But you're not home in your ostensible home country either because you have that constant pull. And that's certainly something that Callie Brown in the Clover House that she experiences. But then hopefully the learning process is that the home is something that you carry within you and it's wherever you are. That took me a long time to say.
and to build on that, I've been talking again a lot about this as I've been going around, and meeting lots of people who, whether they're first generation or second generation, have this very romantic idea about what will happen when they go back to their parents, grandparents, village in whatever part of the world. That somehow that's going to both kind of, like, it will fill that loss that they feel, or they will kind of finally understand who they are or who their parents are and who their grandparents are or whatever. And they almost always, while they might have, good food and they might see some nice museums and they might, see where their mother was born or whatever, in fact, when they leave, they find that they are not changed, that they actually, as you said, not just you can't go home again to feel full or, or fulfilled, but that it actually opens up more questions about who you are and why you've come back. Like, what actually led you back there? What impulse to take you back becomes more of a pressing issue in your mind rather than the answer that you found? And in this novel, the last thing I'll say is that the first generation daughter has this idea that taking her mother back home to where her mother was born is going to somehow heal her, right? It's going to somehow heal the family, and that also has its own kind of repercussions. This sort of romantic idea about what homecoming does for the person who actually does did grow up where they did. So,
I like Caleb's formulation that home is the place where you've made a sufficient number of mistakes. my character is unlike the protagonist you've been hearing that I'm surrounded with, in that she's not on a quest to find home or to reconnect with family. She is wants to get a job done and be on a vacation and get away from her assumed home in New York, where her assumed history is, and then finds out differently. So in a way, she's a reverse Dorothy. Who finds out that home is really Oz, and if there's some philosophical questions about home in there, I guess they would center around our sort of indeterminacy about what really constitutes a home. I never wanted to go to Paris. I always thought that was the most trite thing in the world that I'd ever heard of. So I made it to the age of 35 before ever going there, and I arrived at night and threw open the shutters on the first morning and said to myself, I've wasted my entire life. Because it did feel not just beautiful, but as a home, and has remained as such. And I think maybe so the character reflects that.
And when you say that, though, that she's not on a quest, and I'm not trying to kind of disagree with the authors, but I felt that quest in her from the get-go. And part of it is she addresses, the narrative is addressed to, in the, it's first-person narrative, but addressed to a second person, a former lover, Daniel. And you're immediately drawn into this tension between, where is he? Why is he lost? Why is he irretrievably beyond? And why, what, and what presence is he playing, you know, in this, you know, in this narrative? And there's a moment towards the beginning of the novel, and I'm going to read just from this, where she observes, "Haven't you done this? Woken up in a strange room in a foreign locale and felt yourself adrift without handholds in the silence of the place that is not the silence of any place you know." So there's this sense of like a silence that's extremely, like, brutally unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. And yet further on in that same scene, as she's standing by the cold window, Matilda has a sense that the scene below is an intricate collage of moments from her own past. Mm-hmm. You know, she calls them prodigal memories. And I so love that. But a similar tension, you know, undergirds each of these novels. And can you speak to how that experience of what is unfamiliar gives rise to that opportunity to explore something that's deeply, even inevitably, you know, true to who you are?
You have to understand what a moment this is, because I don't know if other authors have this feeling, but I've been dying for somebody to read my book to me. But how do you ask that?
And I'm dying to read that passage.
So this is actually a big moment for me. I wouldn't mind if you actually read it. But, yeah, you know, Matilda Anselm is like all of us in some ways. She has constructed her life as a scaffolding over the things in her life that are unresolved. And what is unresolved for her is that the love of her life, whom she intended to marry, was killed in Vietnam 24 years before the action of this story starts. And it's not something that she normally dwells on, but it's something that she's built a life of certainty to obscure. And so when she comes to Paris, and the things happen to her there, and partly had to happen outside of her home in New York, because they're disturbing things that throw her entirely off of her balance. She comes to grips finally with what happened to her and her lover. So so that's the quest that I'm pleased to hear that you sense. because I do think that I tried to build in a sense of yearning. She's addressing this entire book as a letter, a series of letters. I hope the letter aspect isn't too obtrusive, but she to Daniel, to her lover, in anger. She's furious with him for leaving her. And in the course of the 300 pages, in the course of a series of unexpectedly traumatic experiences during her time in beautiful Paris, she finally is able to resolve the thing that ruptured her life a quarter of a century earlier. You know, you're apologizing for telling me about my own book. I would love to hear what other people think. I understand so little about my own book, and it is a joy of publishing, beyond joking, that people pick up on things that maybe you hope they pick up on, or maybe you didn't even understand fully yourself. And that's been fun with this book in particular. But Matilda, one way to look at this book that I did intend is that it's all within the framework of her mourning for a lost lover, even though it's an adventure that's very much out there in the world and taking place on the street. Oh, come on. You won't let me get away with that.
You're talking about this sense of loss, and you know, each of these journeys begins with a sense of something, and Chris, you alluded to this, of something that needs to be, you know, pieced back together. Mm-hmm. Something that is missing, something that needs to be retrieved, and somehow this journey will allow for that, you know, constellation or reconstitution of something that's gone. And you mentioned actually Prima, mm-hmm. And that whole, the way that she really schemed, you know, for this trip. Mm-hmm. You know, she organizes the whole family. It takes time for the trip to actually take place, mm-hmm. And all sorts of events happen, mm-hmm. before the trip. But this tension, and Henriette, you alluded to this earlier, about the recognition that what you're looking for in this place, this other place, may in fact already be gone, is brought forth at the end of all this talk of love, in a scene where one night after the family's taken this trip back to Santa Cecilia, which I'm not pronouncing quite right.
No, you're right.
It's better?
Good. Yeah,
okay,
it's good.
Excellent.
No, it's good.
Prima walks with the others up to the gorge to see the stars, and she finds she can't stop looking at the sky, her mother's sky. Now that she's under it, she understands how impossible it would be to leave it, how you could spend the rest of your life feeling small and strange and far away. Slightly further on, she comes to understand and to really see for the first time why her mother, Maddalena, who grew up in Santa Cecilia, did not want to go back, because going home would only remind her of the place that she had left so many years ago, which is now, you know, completely changed. And I'd like to each of you to speak just briefly, you know, Russ, you touched on it, about how loss interfaces with place in your novels, because I think that loss and yearning are really a driving force in each of these stories.
Yeah. Trying not to be repetitive with what I said before, but I think there is, well, in this book at least, there is a naivete on the part of the daughter who, as I said, was so excited to bring this whole family back, and not understanding what happens when you kind of open that Pandora's box of emotions that your parents, or you know, in this case, your parents have kind of shut away, and so a lot of what this book, a lot of what the trip functions as in this book is as once you've kind of broken the seal of even potentially going back or going back, it unleashes all of these other things that people haven't spoken about, various losses, mm-hmm. various regrets, and so the trip itself becomes a kind of catalyst for these other things that happen to the characters and these other memories. And then I was taking my phone out not to like text my friend and ask what we were doing for dinner or something, but because I realized I wanted to look up a quote that I won't be able to find now. I was going to Google it, but now I don't have time. There's a quote from Emerson, who actually makes a bunch of appearances in this book, and he talks about Ralph Waldo Emerson, that is, as opposed to like a cousin named Emerson or something. Because so many Italians are named. Anyway, he talks about his whole passage about traveling is a fool's paradise, and that you go to, and I'm going to botch this quote, but you go to the ruins of Rome and the ruins of Naples to sort of escape your giant that is following you. And when you wake up, the giant is already still there, you know. And the giant goes wherever you go. Mm. And it's again much better than that. And that quote really, despite having botched it, really stuck with me as I was writing this book. This idea that you sort of can't escape those losses as much as you know, as hard as you try. Mm. So
I'm thinking about the fact that I know Patra very well because that's the city in which I set the Clover House. But it's my actual mother's childhood city, and I would spend quite a bit of time there every summer because I would go to Greece every summer with my family. But at some point in the mid to late 80s, my mother stopped going there. And it had been a considerable amount of time since she had been there. And the city really had, just as it began to enter radical changes, she expressed no interest in going anymore. And I think it was sort of what we were talking about, not wanting to confront the reality of time moving forward and changing a place that you're so fond of and altering the landscape in really profound ways that affect that might threaten your memories and therefore your identity or your sense of your identity. And I keep coming back to and I think it has to do with sort of how you position yourself and how our characters position themselves in relation to place, whether they see themselves as immigrants or emigrants or expats, who I guess would be, I mean, in your novel, Caleb, or exiles, or there may be yet another category that I'm not thinking of, but we kind of bundle those terms together because we think that they mean sort of the same thing, the foreigner in another place, but I think they all mean something slightly different, and each of our characters, I suspect, would choose a different one to identify him or herself. I know Callie in the Clover House thinks of herself as an exile, as a self-exile. And that's actually kind of a common thing in Greek culture. Xenitia is, if there are Greeks here, help me with the translation, but it's sort of like a self-exile. Like you enter into the diaspora because you want to leave, but there's the longing for home. It's a little bit like, I think, like saudade, which I'm probably not pronouncing correctly, but the Portuguese term for that sort of longing for an absent place. And that's a really common thing in Greek culture. Mm-hmm. So that's yet another, I think, spin on memory and
place.
And say
for Italians, they have this term called campanilismo, which the campanile is the bell tower of your village, and there's a phrase that says you should never travel so far from home where you can't hear the church bell ringing. And so the idea that you've actually left home, these immigrants who leave, there's a weird sense of like punishment, like you've done something wrong by leaving because you violated that sense of campanilismo.
And this question of exile, could you speak to that?
I was going to talk about mourning
and
place. Prague is a city that's full of memorials to the dead, and churches and monuments. And the character in my novel finds out sometime after he arrives that a friend of his, who he was very close to in America, has killed herself. And so he's got the kind of problem of how to mourn her in a place that's mourning other people, and he's not in his context. And so he ends up spending a lot of time in cemeteries and thinking a lot about sort of what these buildings are memorialized and what memorializing means, what it means to attach a memory to a place and say, this memory happened here and not somewhere else, or this place is special because a catastrophe happened here, or this person is a martyr. But the Czech culture actually has the same idea. Opusti sli zahineš, like if you leave me, you will perish.
It's a little harsher.
They're a little harsher generally. The flip side of that is that in Prague there's a word nezabidlinost, which means not feeling at home. So the sense that Prague was a city that was overrun by the Austrians, was controlled by the Austrians, overrun by the German Nazis, then controlled by the Russians, and then briefly by the Americans, and now I understand it's really Russian tourists again. But I haven't been back. So.
And Jacob arrives there at a time that's, where he's questioning, is the spirit of change, is it gone? Do you know, is it dead? Or he's living in that sort of like, you feel that's a haunting, that's a haunting part of the the sensibility of the place and his experiences there, and there's the personal change, there's the political, kind of coming, becoming an expatriate, having that self-imposed exile at a time when, the place itself, is between what was and what will be.
Yeah, I think he's not sure. He's not always. Is he pursuing the spirit of change or is he pursuing the spirit of death? Because they're linked in some strange way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, in each of these novels, there's a very defined history of the place abroad that becomes essential to the current day story. And as I just mentioned, in a few of the stories, that history is political, as well as personal. In The Clover House, for example, the personal history of Callie's mother Cleo and the political history of occupied Greece during World War II. Become inextricably linked with Callie's own effort to understand her sense of dislocation. And at one point she remarks, it seems the right thing to do, to fold the reality of my days here in Patra into the new history of my mother's life. And that term, new history, really leapt at me. Because in each of these novels also, as one of you mentioned, time functions differently in this other place. Time, past, there's a sense of past and present being overlaid and continually interpenetrating. And whether that history of the place is political or personal, there's a sense of that kind of shifting memory, that shifting understanding of what came before that plays an active and even vital role in the evolution of the narrative. Mm.
And you wanted me to say something about
that. I do. Yeah. I do. Yeah. I mean, you can
well,
tell,
because
the past is continually nudging in well, on each of these on each of these novels.
Yeah, and I think it's constantly forcing Callie to redefine her sense of what is happening in the moment in her own life, but also she's discovering there's some overlap with your protagonist Russ, I think, that she's discovering secrets about, in this case, her family's past, her mother's past. So she's having to recalibrate what she thinks about her mother's history. And then, of course, if she thinks that this is what it looked like over here when her mother was a child, and that's what led to her mother being the way she is now, if you change this, you change what the outcome is. It might not look different on the outside, but of course inside her mother is different, her mother's history is new. And then her own history, Callie's history, has to be new as well. And I think there is at least one scene in the novel of a large family gathering in which the aunts and the mother and Callie are trying to, well, Callie is forcing the issue of trying to recall a family story from these women's childhoods, and none of the women can agree on what actually happened. And I'm sure we all know this from our family holiday tables that people quibble and argue actually and quite heatedly over details of family history. And for Callie, that becomes quite, it shouldn't become traumatic, but given who she is and where she is in her life, it really shakes her.
Because she's looking for closure. She's looking for answers. She's looking for objects right. that will kind of be able to be pieced together.
Right.
And I mean, I think in many ways there's that, again, that tension that we mentioned before, you know, with regard to your novel, Russ, where there's that, and in each of the books, there's that sense that there, you know, the beginning is like coming, you know, looking for something, you know, mm-hmm. but what you find isn't necessarily what you came looking for.
Right.
And we have in common that we're all Americans writing about Europe, and that's the other place for us. And part of that, you can disagree with me, please, but is that and is the sense of history and what you were talking about that the place actually is a tangible force between the protagonist and that history. Mm. I had a real sense of in my book, or maybe that was intended. There was so much about the book that just happened. You know, I did not feel in control of it. And then there were other parts that that were there because I was in control. And part of that, one of those aspects was the apartment that Matilda inherits. Is a tiny room whose former resident has just died and willed the apartment to her. She's never heard of him, doesn't know who he is or why he would have done this. But it resembles, in its almost every last detail, the place that I lived in Paris in the winter of 1990-91, that was a small room that had been previously occupied by a German Jew who had come to Paris to try and escape the Nazis in the mid-30s. And then, of course, events had caught up with him, and he had lived in that room not only through the war hiding, but hiding ever since. And the room still had the blackout curtains pulled down over the window, still had the peephole over the stairwell that you could move aside to see who was coming up the stairwell. So I was living in this room that was, tangible doesn't do it justice, it reeked of a personal history that was almost ghost-like in the premises. And it may have been an attempt to exorcise that ghost, or maybe an attempt just to dance with it that made me move my character in there so that I could grapple again with what was a fairly strong experience for me, living in Paris with a history that I think this rarely happens in the U.S. and, you know, post-Faulkner America. But happens so often in Europe because the history has been so vivid and so awful in many instances there and is still written on the walls of the place.
Jacob, my character Jacob has this idea, you know, came because he wants to be part of history, that right. something historic had just happened. But one thing I sort of played with in the novel was. That the history hadn't yet been written of what had happened. So people were still figuring out how the revolution had happened. So like there is actually a standing mystery about the Velvet Revolution, that there was this big protest, and supposedly someone died, and that created an even bigger protest. But it's not actually clear that anyone did die. In fact, it's pretty clear that nobody did in that first day of events. So I play with that in the novel, because it's true that the police are suspected of having been trying to politic against the establishment communist regime in order to, and nobody's quite sure what their motive was. But so I have one of the characters possibly planting that rumor through some student journalists, but it doesn't happen on stage, it happens off screen. But I mean, I was trying to play with things like that history hadn't been written yet, and there is this sort of, maybe because I write about history as a scholar, that's interesting to me, that seam between oral knowledge and written knowledge, and how do those things get digested, and who says what, and what things don't make it into the written record, but actually are part of the folk memory of this particular CIA agent, so.
Yeah, and one of the, in my novel, which is much more of a family novel without politics is really a part of it.
There's family politics.
Oh yeah, which are the most dangerous of all. I made the decision to tell the story from four different perspectives. So there's sections where the mother narrates, the father, the son, the sister, and one of the reasons I did that is because, as you were saying, each person has their own interpretation, their own sense of the real story, and I wanted to sort of just to make that, sort of embed that into the novel. And again, this impulse to go back to the village is an impulse to find the real story, or like the true story, or what it was really like. And I wanted to kind of not to suggest that there is no such, there's no such thing. There's only the mother's story. There's only the father's story. There's only the way that one person interprets their family. And, I toyed in an early draft, I toyed with the idea of having the narrator be a writer, which, is just, no one's done that before. And I wanted the character to be writing a novel about the experience. And then I thought, no, I didn't want, I mean, for this particular story, although that would work, I think, perfectly, I wanted to keep suggesting that it was really just each person's stories were the stories.
So. I should say, I decided that I did want to offer the reader the truth in the Clover House. And so the World War II sections of the novel are the truth, the truth of the fiction of the novel. Mm-hmm. But because I wanted the reader to be able to see that Callie doesn't arrive at that actual truth, because none of us does. Mm-hmm. None of us do. And so the reader gets the experience of knowing, the satisfaction, perhaps, of knowing what actually happened definitively, and then seeing where the protagonist comes close and where she doesn't.
And I just have one more question, and then we're going to open up to questions from you. But, one of the things that that I pay a lot of attention to, because I teach workshops on structure and the structure of a novel. In each of these novels, to a certain extent, you have the structure, you have the arc of the novel, but to a certain extent, it's dictated by the fact that there's going to be a leave-taking. The fact that there's going to be, at the end of the novel, or not, that there's going to be this returning home, or to what was home, and each of you treat that slightly differently. Caleb, I thought it was really interesting how it was Jacob's imminent leave-taking that allows him to have a relationship that actually creates more of a sense of connection, than what would have been possible if he wasn't leaving. Mm-hmm. But each of you have that sort of, that leaving, that imminent leaving, as something, that the knowing that you will be going home, from this other place. And can you talk about how that worked in your process? Do you know what I mean? Like how it kind of informed the arc of the novel, kind of driving forward, but at the same time knowing that that's where you were going to arrive? because it's not like arriving at a climax in a, you know, in a, you know, if you think about the arc of a novel as a, you know, as that five part piece, because there's also that sense that this in some of the novels here, there was a sense of closure that allowed for that homecoming. You know, and in others, the knowing that we would the leave taking is what generated a certain degree of the kind of resolution. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
And I have had some readers get mad at me that my character gives up her Paris. I'm not supposed to tell you this, but
still by the book,
right? Who knows if I'm telling the truth? But gives up her Paris apartment and goes back to New York, and I was fairly upset about it too, and wasn't sure until I got close to the end that that's what she was going to decide to do. But as in other things, she. Wasn't interested in listening to me, and was interested more in doing what was true to herself and her character. But I can say, I think this is an example of what you're mentioning, that in a way, she could not have gone home to the degree that she does without the things that happened to her in Paris. So the whole idea of a trip abroad, experiences abroad, gets turned on its head into this being, for the first time, a journey home, and that couldn't have happened without the meander.
Mm-hmm. And I'll say too that just to build on that, that the daughter in this in the novel makes this announcement at the beginning of the book that she's bought these tickets and the family, she's taking the family back to Italy, and of course there's major disagreement about whether they're going, and the mother doesn't want to go, the father wants to go, the other brother takes sides, the whole thing. And as I was writing it, I actually didn't know, as you were saying, I didn't know if they were ever going to make it. I had absolutely no idea. And so I was writing the book to figure out whether they were going to make it. And then as the book went on, I learned reasons why the trip would become necessary if they were. I'm not going to say. Well, I already did. They already did say whether they made it. But I mean, this for the writers in the room. You know, the book taught me how to write it. The process of writing taught me how to write it. Taught me how to end it. And also, you know, that gun at the beginning of the novel, the gun going, the gun on the table of this trip to Italy had to go off. You know, at some point, or it would be not have been a satisfying novel, most likely. So.
I think in mine, you know that Callie is going to deal with this inheritance, and she's planning to return. That's always clear. And whether she's going to have to extend her stay because she's not done, or because she feels that she hasn't, not done with the logistics, or not done with the sort of other more complicated matters that she's beginning to discover, I won't say whether she extends her stay or not. But I knew that. I knew she was going to go and come back. And I knew also, because the novel is set during Carnival in Patra. Patra is kind of like the New Orleans of Greece, and it's a huge, massive celebration.
And that's where you're from?
No, that's where my mother is from. That's where my mother is from. I take after my father's Balkan side of the family. And Athenian. But at the end of Carnival finishes with a Forgiveness Sunday Mass. I mean, and then Lent. So, and the novel was in my working title was Clean Monday, which is the day that Lent begins in Greece. So I knew there was going to be this arc of forgiveness, but I didn't know where Callie and her mother were going to put themselves on that arc. I didn't know whether there was going to be forgiveness for them or just out there in the carnival structure. Mm-hmm. So that was something that the novel kind of showed me mm-hmm. where I was going to go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of this before, but I guess should I stay or should I go now is kind of the through line of my novel also, because Jacob arrives and in most of the first section, much of the first section, he's wondering if he should even stay at all.
Right.
And then in the second section, a friend of his comes from America and he sort of becomes involved in this friend's story, and the whole second section, which is the longest, is sort of him watching his friend's story unfold in Prague, and then his friend leaves, and then he stays. And as you say, in the third section, he has a relationship that maybe at that stage of his development is only possible because he knows it's temporary.
Right. And it's so beautiful. It's so beautifully rendered. Sorry.
Thank you. Well, and for him, the other thing is am I being responsible or irresponsible by staying away? And like, should I go home and get a job and be the kind of person I thought I was supposed to grow up to be, or should I stay abroad and I'm not sure he makes the right decision in the end. But that's also part of it. Like, it's commitment to people, commitment to vocation.
And in a way, it's what allows him to really discover the place.
Mm-hmm.
He's leaving.
Yeah.
So it sounds like we brought all of our characters home, but are we done? Or do you feel like the question remains unanswered for you and you're going to have to pursue it in the next one? Well, I know you're writing about expats.
Yeah, so. I'm writing about expats now. Expat Americans in Greece.
Do you feel like it's a continuation of the question?
Yeah, I think I'm a one-trick pony. This is an issue that really, it's an issue that really concerns me. It's my idée fixe, and right now in Greece, the notion of who is a citizen and who belongs and immigration and an economic crisis and all of that, you put that all together, and to me it's a very attractive, sadly attractive, context in which to write about people who are living abroad.
Okay, so we have time for one or two questions. Yes. So the question is, how did your character's experience abroad affect their understanding of what America is and what it means to be American?
Well, I can't really answer the question because my character doesn't come back to America till the end of the novel, and then the novel's over. But there is a sense that he's the innocent abroad, and I think that one thing that happens is, or maybe it only happens for the reader, or hopefully it happens for the reader, is there's a little bit of alienation from that identity of an innocent abroad, and that maybe if you're a young American abroad, you aren't really innocent, in that you're part of this political empire and dominant superpower, and your presence will change the narrative, that just your presence there will change the way that things are perceived around you. So I guess for my character anyway, there's a little bit of dislocation in his sense of the innocence of being an American.
Well, this is a very oblique answer, so you'll have to decode it. But I was very worried, of course, that I would get details wrong, either in the history or in some of the religion or some of these other aspects, and I had that fact check. And I was very worried that I would have details wrong about Paris, about France, and be shown up, you know. So I gave it to some authorities, since I didn't have time to go over there. They got to walk around with my book and be sure that all the locales were right. I'm still forgiving them. But what they said was, when they'd read the book, was the train to Grand Central doesn't go through Queens, it goes through the Bronx. turns out all my errors were right in my own backyard. Make of that what you will, but I appreciate America all anew, having written a novel in a foreign place.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to speak?
I don't think mine really... It has.
Well, it does. I mean, it does in a sense. And I mean, I love Antonio's. I love Antonio's assessment of what America, right? Mm-hmm. What America is. Mm-hmm. Like the, I'm going to like botch the quote, but it's just.
And I won't be able to correct you because I probably don't even remember it.
But you don't?
No. Go ahead.
But it's just like the big. It's towards the beginning of the novel. I have it in my mind, and I loved it, and it made
I can
me
see
love.
It too, but I can't remember.
You
it.
You can't remember it, and you know, Cleo's experience of America at the beginning is she's
Cleo, when she arrives, I think this is
in America,
really, when she right. It's not really in the book, but it's implied, I think you can infer, that she leaves Greece with her American husband in the 50s, because Greece, for reasons I won't go into, has become a very difficult place for her, and she thinks it's going to be better in America looks like the land of promise to her. And what she finds is that she, when we talked about people bringing their home with them, she brings her kind of problematic home with her. So America is
but
a place
that she...
But it
also opens, the novel opens with this incredible scene of all the...
The packing paper from the moving boxes, which she puts on the window so that
she doesn't have to look outside and see America.
Yeah. I will say real quick that what is true about Antonio, which is, he's the immigrant, which is true about so many of what I've seen in in my family is that when they come, the very first feeling is longing for the home they just left, just homesickness. But then it's this romance they have with America. America is the land of, you know, the land they could be somebody, and they just trust in America and what America is. And then the end of life, toward the end of life, they go back to sort of re-romanticizing the village and wanting to go back there and again to try to reclaim something. So one thing I do in that beginning is sort of trace that relationship between the homeland and the new land, and then going back again. So.
Great. Well, we have we're going to have all four authors signing books outside, and I want to thank you all so much for coming today.
Thank you, Dawn, for a great question.